LeanCast, Product Innovation and UX Design with Bonanza Design.
What's up, everybody? It's LeanCast, another episode. We talk innovation, product innovation, and UX. And time has arrived. I'm here with the one and only Andy Carville, and I need to give a really good introduction here. If I am being humble about this, he is among top 10 growth strategies, mobile growth strategies in the world, co-founder and partner of Feature, award-winning, the best in my opinion, mobile growth consultancy, and it's here, it's now. He is in front of me. I managed to lock him in for 60 minutes. We're going to talk about app UX. I don't know what to expect, but I know it's going to be great. Andy, thanks for coming on the podcast. How are you doing?
It's a pleasure to be here. Behrad, thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this. So yeah, I'm doing good. It's also Friday here, just about to hit the weekend. So yeah, looking forward to this immensely.
Andy, if you were to give a rundown of your background and how you ended up here, where would you start?
I usually start pretty far back because there's a very poignant moment in my early childhood. I was about 5 years old when my father came home with a programmable home computer system, a ZX Spectrum 48K, and began to teach me and my brother, who's a bit older than me, how to program it. This was back in, 1982 or so, back in the UK, where I'm from. And my father was one of the first generation of computer programmers. He was programming on mainframe computers for the British Gas Corporation, as it was then, initially with punch cards. So he was really, really one of the very first computer programmers in the country, that was trained up specifically by the manufacturers of these computer systems, I think probably IBM or something. So anyway, when in the UK, there was a pretty thriving home computer scene, which developed, some years after the mainframes came in. My dad was keen that my brother and I would be part of that, part of that scene and part of that experience. So he was really keen to introduce us to computers from a very early age. And, of course, I was fascinated by computers and, I love computers. Particularly, I love computer games, and I was really, I love programming, but I focused all of my efforts on programming games, which, was not always a great success when I was, 5, 6 years old. I think I wrote my first game when I was 5, but it was not very good. But, this is also how you improve, right? You keep trying and you learn more things and you get better at it. So that's where I would start, right? So let's fast forward a few more years. I think gradually I got better at programming computer games, learning from books and from other folks in the scene. There was no internet back then, but, at some point I went to university, I studied a bachelor's degree in computer science, so I would have a piece of paper that would help me get into the games industry, along with my games demo showreel. So I was applying for jobs at games companies in the UK. The UK, because of this home computer scene, had a lot of really good game publishers, game developers there. So I was applying to places like Virgin Games, EA, Codemasters, like some of these names you might have heard of. My agent at the time, who was helping me to get a job in the games industry, also got me an interview with Nokia, who were hiring for game developers for their to put games onto their handsets, which were at the time were black and white, around about 84 by 48 pixels display, kind of relatively resource constrained devices. And I didn't even own a mobile phone back then, but I went for the interview anyway. And I was pretty blown away by, the R&D facility that Nokia had. Nokia were on top of the world back then, so they had some serious resources at their disposal. And I actually got chatting with who became my boss because I took the job. But, I think he convinced me, it was a sort of a different kind of interview to what I'd been having with the games companies. The games companies, give you an IQ test, and they, you know, they maybe give you a coding test, and they want to see your game development showreel and stuff. You know, I'd made a Game Boy Advance game as a demo, you know, and a PlayStation game. So I was comfortable in that environment. But I think what I realized with Nokia, we're kind of coming at it from a different perspective. And frankly, they were also paying more than the games guys, because the traditional games industry was, you know, notorious back then. I'm not sure if it's got better. But back then, they were notorious for working people to the bone and paying them as little as they could get away with, because they would say, well, look, you're working in games. It's very cool. You know, you should be grateful to be here. Whereas Nokia seemed to be a bit more progressive. They're a Scandinavian company, Finnish. You know, they had tons of money. Obviously, back then, they were really like, they had something like 80% market share on mobile phones, which was growing pretty nicely. So it was, you know, it seemed like actually it might be a nicer like environment from a sort of a, you know, kind of employee welfare point of view, but also actually I was super excited by the opportunity to work on a very resource constrained environment. It was like an interesting resource optimization problem. So, you know, these games had to fit into around about 16 kilobytes of code and graphics, like everything combined, code and data into 16K. They had to run on relatively low power CPU systems, also like kind of multitasking with other phone operating system code that's running in the background. As a kind of a fairly hardcore coder, which is what I used to consider myself, you know, it's actually a lot of fun to work in a resource constrained environment like that. And every problem becomes an optimization problem. So you have to code, you have to code smart, you know, like you can't just throw like a load of stuff in and hope that it runs all right. You've got to really optimize every loop and every available resource to the fullest. And, you know, and I got to make some fun games. I made a game called Space Impact, which was a side scrolling arcade shoot 'em up game. It's probably the first one on a mobile phone. And, you know, that harked back to my childhood days of playing games like Scramble in the arcade. So it was, you know, I was able to recreate some of the games I played in my childhood on a device which was going to be sold to, I think in the end, the device there was that was the 3310 that I launched that game on. It was on something like 126 million devices. So was
wow.
Able to be, you know, people were able to play that all around the world. And that was pretty exciting, you know, as to me, still is exciting to think about that. And, you know, that made a bunch of games since, was in the games industry as it became a mobile games industry for the next 10 years or so at various companies. I'm getting to the end of this story, by the way. But after about 10 years making games, I decided I wanted to sort of learn a few new things as well. I went to business school for a year.
Sure.
I had a lot of respect, actually, for some folks that I'd met throughout my 10 years career who had gone and done an MBA at business school. And I kind of wanted to, you know, be like those people, because they seemed like, you know, they knew a lot and they were very adaptable and capable people. And so I was like, maybe that's something for me. So I went, I applied for business schools. I did my MBA, and that's what brought me to Berlin, where I figured I would probably end up back in the games industry in some respect. I was doing a project to finish my MBA, my dissertation. And I worked that with an ad tech company called SponsorPay. They're now called Fiber. Mm-hmm. They just got bought by Digital Turbine, actually. But back then they were called SponsorPay. And they were working mostly with games companies to do monetization, both on web and just starting out on their journey in mobile, actually. Now they're mostly known as a mobile ad network. But back then, they also did a lot of web traffic. And they had like offer walls and various forms of like monetization possibilities for companies that publishers or creators of games that wanted to monetize their traffic. So I did a customer loyalty project with them. Was not particularly falling in love with the world of ad tech, but it was an interesting insight into that business. So I'm always grateful to SponsorPay for that. Decided to stay in Berlin, because I did fall in love with Berlin, and that's what brought me to SoundCloud, which is they were looking for somebody. You know, when I started looking around for jobs because I wanted to stay in Berlin, I saw that SoundCloud were hiring, and they wanted somebody who could help them really understand mobile and transition from being a web-first product to being a mobile-first product, and to really build a mobile audience. And that was really, you know, the dream job for me, because certainly in terms of my background, it was really ticking a lot of boxes. You know, I had a lot of experience already, like I think something like 12 years experience in mobile at that point, which was more than most people. SoundCloud, obviously a fantastic company, fantastic platform. So I joined there. I was there for 4.5 years in various roles. I joined it, started in the marketing team, ended up running a growth team, which was actually under product. We weren't really building product experiences so much as optimizing across marketing and product for growth. And I guess we'll talk more about that later. But it was a fantastic opportunity to work in a high growth startup environment with a lot of data, a lot of opportunity for optimization of growth tech. So, you know, what I forgot to mention is, you know, studying the MBA, I really kind of got interested in marketing specifically, and I really specialized during that year in marketing and marketing strategy. So being able to combine that technical background and the mobile background with a newfound passion for marketing, that's really what growth is all about, right? It's kind of combining tech and data, you know, with marketing to do data-driven growth work. And so that's kind of where I kind of learned a lot of what we're now doing at Feature. It's also where I met my co-founder, Moritz. So Moritz Dan, he was also in the growth team at SoundCloud. And we started, you know, we worked very well together. We shared a lot of the same views on how things should be done in a growth perspective. We ran a lot of experiments together. We drove a ton of impact for SoundCloud. And we also released something called the Mobile Growth Stack. That was something that I originally published back in 2014. And then I worked on it a bit with Moritz the next year, and we published together an update. And it was this framework, which was basically my attempt to bring some clarity to the world of mobile and or mobile growth specifically, and basically a one-page cheat sheet for mobile growth marketers, sort of a tool for building a roadmap for growth of your mobile app. That framework took on a bit of a life of its own. It became very popular in the industry, and it became clear at some point that there were a lot of companies out there that needed help with this, that needed help figuring out how to grow mobile apps, that they loved this resource, this framework that I created, and that they were looking for more help than just a blog post and a framework, but they actually wanted to work with me and Moritz to actually unlock some of that growth and apply the framework. So that's really how we ended up starting Feature, because we had a lot of natural demand from the market. We were being asked to kind of come and go and do these consulting gigs. And even though neither of us had been consultants before, we tried it out and we realized we could do it. And we're like, okay, let's start a company. Let's see how big we can take this.
Now it got so big. How big are you right now?
In terms of employees, we're 150 full-time, mostly in Berlin.
But, wow.
I didn't expect it to be that big, but what I've seen, you know, over the last 6 years, that was 6 years ago that we started the company, and you know, I feel like we're just scratching the surface of the market opportunity. Actually, there's so many brands out there that are still at the beginning of their journey for, like, building a mobile presence and building like genuine mobile experiences that they can interact with their customers or target audiences. And as we've built the company bigger and added more capabilities and disciplines, we've been able to work with bigger and bigger brands, you know, folks like Adobe, folks like the NBA, folks like Lego, and it's great to be able to work with brands like that, and be able to help them to achieve their objectives on mobile. And so, feel like we're just at the start of the journey.
Wow, I like your ambition. I remember I've been following Feature for a good 6 years as well, and I think we had a lunch. It was in Richard Plus in Neukölln. I think you hired your first intern, or like maybe early interns, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And it's been 6 years in the works. And one thing that I admire a lot about Feature is that you have been consistently operating at such a high level, What's the secret sauce behind Feature?
Well, I mean, first of all, thanks for the kind words. You know, like we definitely have high standards. I hope that we almost always achieve them. You know, like of course, I think everybody also makes mistakes sometimes, and I'd be the first to admit that. I actually have a podcast all about making mistakes in the industry. I just wanted to kind of have that caveat, but. Great to see that we have a strong reputation, and you know, I hope that it's well deserved. If I would say what our secret source is, I could be pretty clear on this. It's knowledge sharing, right? Genuine knowledge sharing, not content marketing, as in just, you know, creating a blog post that ticks a few boxes in terms of keywords or, you know, that seems to be on trend, but genuinely sharing. Can be blog posts, can be podcast episodes, can be frameworks, can be conference talks, you know, you can call it, you know, all of that stuff does fall under the content marketing umbrella. But like, you know, we do that stuff out of a genuine belief that by giving away a lot of what we know and telling people what we do and how we do it, this is the most authentic form of marketing, if you want to call it that. And it's also just genuinely rewarding, you know, and it doesn't harm our business. Yes, we probably have competitors that pick up on some of that stuff and apply it in their businesses. That's fine. A lot of people will just take what we, you know, put out there into the world and use it themselves. And I would encourage them to do so. You know, that's why we're sharing this stuff. A lot of other folks will take a look at our, you know, the knowledge that we're putting out there. Through these various channels that I mentioned, we also have, I think, Slack communities with like a few thousand industry members on, including competitors. We're fine with that too. I believe, you know, everybody's learning here, and we're trying to build communities. You know, we have many, many more folks who, you know, read our advanced ASO book, or, you know, do one of our Feature Academy courses, or, you know, look at our new framework for App Store optimization, for example, or for subscription optimization. And they like it. They love that it's actionable. We tell them enough that they can definitely take it and use it, but they still want to come to us and actually have us help them do it, because they like, they respect us as experts. And they, you know, I think there's no more genuine way to convince people that you can help them than by telling them exactly how you would help them, and, you know, making that public. Like, we've got nothing to hide, and we're also very happy if somebody else comes along and says, hey, you could actually do this better if you would do it this way and that way. That's the benefit of being, having a kind of an open source philosophy to service industry, I think. And I guess that's our secret sauce.
I remember early days that you published a mobile growth stack, and it's such a healthy attitude you have towards knowledge sharing and like giving away your secret sauces. And one of the first questions I remember I was asking myself is that, isn't this crazy what Andy's doing, just like giving away? But more and more I realized that, you know, I'm running Bonanza Design as well, and there should not be any fear of like giving away your secret sauce, because whatever you see on Feature website, folks, is few version behind what they are practicing right now internally. It's always, there is a gap. So that's what folks, they don't see when they go check out like website or like, you know, resource books or resource websites. It's like usually what agencies or like practitioners of certain craft doing on a daily basis is few iteration ahead of what you are seeing in their like blogs.
Yeah, I guess that's largely true. Just not even because we're trying to, you know, only release stuff after it's, you know, been declassified. Right. You know, we don't, it's not really a deliberate process. It's more just that it takes time to actually write that stuff and publish it and, you know, get it looking good. And so, yeah, there will be a lag. And I certainly hope that we're always iterating and improving, you know, like we want to be always at the forefront of these disciplines. And we definitely encourage the whole team, you know, to be constantly improving processes and things. So yeah, I think you're right. There's probably what we're doing at the coal face is a little bit more advanced than what we're publishing. We try to close that gap. However, we wouldn't be afraid of publishing something that we're doing right now. It's just hard to do it in real time. And that's where live streaming, which would probably get a bit tiresome to watch.
Your time is valuable, and I would like to jump into a topic that we are both interested in, app UX.
Great.
You know, one of the advantages of having Andy here is, I don't know how many projects you are running right now.
We have something like 45 active customers, I think.
God bless you. Wow, that's a lot. So having someone like Andy on the podcast, being in between 45 projects, actual projects, most of the agency project folks is usually their large scale, right? You know, if you're coming to feature for project, you're not coming to just like do, I don't know, update your banners or something. You want feature team to sort of like look into all your app store optimization. So having him on the podcast is a unique opportunity because he can talk from the state of the art of app UX, state of the art of onboarding optimization, state of the art of app store optimization or what have you. So without further ado, why is it so important to deliver a consistent UX across the board from where, you know, the audience see an ad in the app stores all the way to onboarding and the entire app experience?
Yeah, great question. And I definitely really believe that it is very important to have that consistent UX and messaging across all of your touch points with the user, right? I think first and foremost, it's because you're trying to establish a coherent brand identity, right? Mm-hmm. And if there is incoherence between what you're doing in your advertising and what you're saying in your advertising about your product, you know, and the benefits of the product and, you know, the value proposition, if that's something different than what you say in your app store listing, then first of all, you're going to lose people along that journey before they've even installed the app. Some of them won't, mm-hmm. because they'll click on the ad, then they'll read your app store, you know, screenshot annotations, or just looking at the screenshots themselves, and they'll read the title and they'll read the description, and they'll make a quick judgment call. Is this an app for me? You know, maybe they've been led there by an advert, maybe they've discovered it organically, but you know, they need to be forming that impression at the app store page that yes, this is something that belongs on my phone that I'm going to use, right? Then they click the install button. Then they're launching the app for the first time. Now, if they see something different to what they expect, it can be like as subtle as just like you're using maybe different visual language, different fonts, or different tone of voice in their text. That can already be enough, even on at least on a subconscious level, to make people a little bit, you know, it's jarring for them in terms of their perception. And, mm-hmm. you know, it makes them maybe feel a bit uncomfortable about the choice they just made to download. Or maybe this actually is not the app that I expected it was, you know. So you need to be really reinforcing, setting that expectation, defining that expectation correctly in your advertising and your app store based on your understanding of the audience and the problem that your app is solving. And then absolutely you need to be delivering that that same impression, ideally in the very first screen of the app, right? Because, you know, what we see is that a lot of folks, they'll have a marketing team or a marketing person, you know, doing the advertising. Maybe they have an app store person doing the app store page. They have a product team working on the product itself. And if those teams are not talking to each other, which happens even in relatively small companies, but certainly happens more at the bigger scale companies, then they start to like, you know, develop their own styles. And, you know, then you have a brand coherence problem and a positioning coherence problem more precisely. And why is that important? Well, because if the user is not convinced that this is the same app that's going to solve the problem that they clicked the ad about, you know, mm-hmm. then they're not going to even complete the onboarding process. They're going to go away. So we see, you know, a lot of the best apps, the best practice out there is really to restate the value proposition, ideally in exactly the same language that you've used in the advert and in the app store. You know, tell them again what it is they've just downloaded. Tell them on the first screen, you know, before you get them to sign in or do any onboarding. You know, Evernote does this really well. I think it's got a few different like kind of taglines, but one of them is like access your notes everywhere. And it actually cycles through these use cases and these taglines on the very first page, the sign up page when you launch the app. And you know, there are many other examples of apps which are, you know, reinforcing their tagline or their, you know, their value proposition as the first thing that the users see when they download the app.
It's interesting, like, because one thing I picked up is that restating the value, core value offering, restating mm-hmm. it, basically dangling the carrot, don't lose it. And often it goes in the opposite when we're designing these applications, right? And sometimes we work with the client, with their marketing, and then the client wants to say something differently in the onboarding process than they have it in the marketing, in the app stores like banners. The idea here is like, no, let's just not repeat ourselves. But seems like...
I definitely would recommend you do repeat yourself, you know. So you need consistency. You need to build that bridge between, you know, the mm-hmm. out-of-app experience and the in-app experience. And you have to get the user to walk along that bridge. And, you know, if it's shaky because it's you're using different language or, you know, pushing different things, it's going to be confusing for the user.
Fantastic. Another one. I'm going to go through lots of questions I have.
Hit me.
What's the difference between onboarding and activation?
Great question. These terms are often used very interchangeably, right? And mm-hmm. I don't mm-hmm. want to be a pedant about it because, you know, as long as you understand what you mean, I guess it's fine. But like, it's always, I think, good to try to standardize around the definitions. So the definitions that I use and that I believe are fairly industry standard is that onboarding is about introducing the product, introducing that value proposition or reintroducing it, as we've just said, you're actually introducing it, first of all, outside of the app. But, you know, the onboarding as it exists within the product. And also I would include onboarding, by the way, to be any messaging that you're sending. Things like welcome email is definitely part of onboarding, even though it's not in the product itself. You know, any CRM around the product in the first session or first few sessions, I would consider onboarding. It's about setting the user up for success. Maybe there's kind of work that the user needs to do in order to have a good experience within the app or for the app to function properly, right? These need to be covered in onboarding. I'm talking about things like permissioning. Maybe you need the user's location. Maybe you need the user's the user to turn on push notifications because that's the way that you're going to let them know when something's happening that they're going to need to use the app for. You know, maybe you need to ask the user questions and get information from the user. What is their goal weight, you know, in a weight loss app? What is their, you know, what is their current weight? You know, all of these kind of things that help them to help you to create a more customized experience for the user. So that, you know, maybe a lot of things that you're actually asking them in that onboarding phase, which you're hopefully going to use later. You shouldn't be asking the user for stuff if you're not going to use it. But it's really about setting the user up for a great experience within the app. Okay, now activation, on the other hand, is much more about the user. So onboarding is really about, yes, it's about bringing the user along on a journey, but onboarding is mostly done for you as a developer, as a product creator. You're kind of getting the user to a good state where they're likely to be able to experience the value of the app. Activation is when they are experiencing that value of the app. Right? It's often called the aha moment, right? Ideally, your aha moment is also your activation step, right? It's when the user experiences the value of the app for the first time. So some onboarding processes, by the way, this is where it gets confusing, right? Some onboarding processes actually force the user to do things in the app in the first session. So they may actually activate in that first session if they go through the whole onboarding step. So this is where it gets a bit, you know, it can be confusing. But like a lot of onboarding flows, they're more about just providing some information, gathering some information maybe from the user, doing any permissioning setup, getting the user in good state. And then the activation itself happens when they start using the app and they do the core action, as it's often known, you know, for the first time. So some examples of what that might be, you know, for SoundCloud, it was listening to their first track, you know, it's like getting them to a point where, so the onboarding hopefully sets them up to get them to a point where they can discover a track that they actually want to listen to. the activation itself is when they listen to that first track. And you might define activation even more strictly, right? You might say, well, actually, they need to listen to three tracks, or I don't know, maybe it's, let's go back to the weight loss app example again. Maybe in LifeSum, I've got to track three meals, you know, within the first week to be considered activated. Like, it's really up to you as a product developer how you define that. And you can use data to guide you as to, like, you know, it should be the point when the user really gets the value of the app and hopefully starts to build a habit around it. Sometimes you need to get a user to, you know, see that value a few times before they start to really get it. So it really depends on your product, but it's about when they experience the value proposition.
Say that you started working with one of Fortune 500 companies or one of these hottest startups, and you got access to their Figma file. And the Figma file is about their onboarding experience. And you see too many screens. Generally speaking, how would you go about managing the number of screens that go into the onboarding experience? How much is too much? And how would you sort of like try to arrive at an onboarding experience that doesn't feel too long?
This is a great question, but it's also a leading question. Because there's an implicit assumption there that a long onboarding experience is bad, right? And it's and that it's going to be less effective than a shorter, snappier one. Now, oftentimes you're absolutely right. That is the case, right? And what we would always say is to let the data guide you, right? You can map out your onboarding steps as a funnel, right? So if you've got analytics and you're tracking who's completing each step of the onboarding process, each screen, maybe it's 10 screens long, and they have to do certain things at different screens. Some of them they're just reading, others maybe they have to contribute some information. You can track all of that in your analytics, and you absolutely should. It's probably one of the most important things to track. So once this is implemented and it's in the app, you can get data to see who's dropping off where, and you know, like how many people are actually completing this, and what's their subsequent retention and activation rate. And that second question is actually really critical, because if you only look at completion rates of the onboarding, but not the subsequent activation, then you're optimizing for the wrong thing. Like you can optimize for a really short onboarding process, but remember that the goal is not to complete the onboarding; it's to activate. So if a really short onboarding process results in a higher activation rate, which it often will, then fantastic. You know, you've optimized your onboarding process and succeeded in the goal, which is higher activations. If, however, you're cutting out screens from your onboarding and you don't see any change in your activation rate, or maybe it even goes down, which we've also seen, you know, then you're optimizing for the wrong thing. But back to your question, I think it's even more challenging when it's just a Figma file, because what I'm talking about is implementing it into the product, and, you know, getting some data and then saying, okay, we can have a conversation around this data. Now, if you're looking at two Figma files, like a longer onboarding and a shorter onboarding, and you have to have a debate about which one's better. Now, honestly, that gets tough. And I'm not going to say that the shorter one always wins, right? A great example of an app with a really long onboarding is Fastic. It's a intermittent fasting app. I've used it myself quite a bit. It's got a wonderful onboarding. It's highly interactive. It's fun. It's got like animations and nice graphics. It's about, I think it's between 10 and 20 screens long. It's really long.
Wow.
And I had the pleasure of being in I was teaching a workshop in collaboration with Braze over in Vegas at MAU Vegas, which is a Mobile Apps Unlocked. It's a big conference out there for mobile folks. And one of the Fastic founders was in the room. And I was using Fastic as an example on the screen and saying, you know, this is a really long onboarding, but I'm not going to say that it's bad because I haven't seen their numbers, right? And it's a very nice onboarding. It's just very long. And he said, actually, our activation rate is 80%, which is insanely high, by the way. Like, you know, I've seen much shorter onboardings with activation rates, you know, much closer to like 40% for new users. So they are acing it with a really long onboarding.
Wow.
So, you know, it's as much as, you know, I'd love to give you a simple rule here or a simple process, as in many things in life, it's not that simple. So it's really tough. I would say when you've got two Figma files, I would say try to get some data behind it, whether that's mocking it up with mobile in-app messages, which can be a way to kind of do things quickly. Maybe you can get some people to do a user test and just sort of see very closely if they start to lose attention or something. You know, or if you've got the resources, you know, build those flows and A/B test them against each other and see what rocks out. But don't just look at onboarding completion rates, look at also your activation rates subsequently.
That's such a golden tip. It's like, do not over optimize for onboarding. You have to optimize for the entire journey, because the end goal is activation, is not onboarding.
Yeah, and I'm just going to even contradict myself a bit further here. Activation is even just like an interim step, right? Your end goal is user retention, right? So you want those users to actually stick around long after activation. Activation is actually just the first step on the retention journey. So yeah, onboarding hopefully sets them up for activation. Activation hopefully sets them up for longer term retention. So of course, then if you're running experiments looking at retention a month later, then those experiments are going to take at least a month to run. So that you get into like difficult challenges in terms of like where to draw the line. You know, maybe you really want to look at 1 year retention, but do you really have one year to run that experiment until you get your results? Like most companies wouldn't. But yeah, just activation is not even the end goal, but it's a pretty useful proxy.
Andy, I know you are like, I know you from my personal experience that you'd like to be exact, but I would like to put you to in a situation. Let's say there are 100 people visiting an app, the App Store. Walk me through the activation and retention journey. Out of 100, how many, on average, how many should I expect in a healthy scenario? Again, very average, ballpark, go past, hit the onboarding. Out of those people, how many would go past, you know, start using the application? How many of those go past, get activated? How many of those I should expect to retain at the end?
Yeah, okay, so this is a great question. And yeah, the numbers are really scary. So, you know, the average Android app loses 80% of its users within, I think, a couple of days, right? It's a scary funnel, right? Within a few days, right? So the average, right? This includes all the really shitty apps at the bottom of the App Store, the Play Store, rather, you know, it includes also the really, really highly engaging apps like TikTok, right? So this is a blended average. You can only learn so much from averages. What I can tell you is, like, retention rates are fairly category specific. So you're going to see a different benchmark for a music streaming app than you will for a social app, than you will for a news app, etc. But to give you some idea in concrete terms, we had pretty good retention at SoundCloud. I was running the retention team, so of course we had good retention. No, I'm joking. Of course, like we were able to improve it a fair bit, but. You know, SoundCloud, I would say, was definitely in the upper quartile as far as retention went for that category. And we had around 50% month zero retention. So that's basically at the end of the first month, we still had around 50% of the new users. Now, that's pretty good for most categories. Like, I'd say, you know, if you want to know what to expect, particularly if you're just starting out, and you know, if you're just starting out, you're going to have to do some iteration on your product before it's as good as SoundCloud was. You know, this is I'm talking about SoundCloud like 5-6 years in, you know, not when they first launched. So you know, I think a more realistic kind of goal for like early days retention at the end of the first month would be something like 30-40% of your users. So 30-40 of those 100 may be still around after 1 month. If you can get that really off the bat, then I think you're already doing pretty well. You know, something like around a 40% day one retention would also be a pretty good thing to aim for. So day one is like they're coming back specifically 1 day after they installed.
Got it.
You know, but like the curve goes like this. Like you know, if you get 40% coming back on day one, it's more like 30% on day two, and so on. Doesn't mean they might not come back on another subsequent day.
Right.
So yeah, we're getting now into the specifics and trying to be exact about how to measure retention. You know, it's quite a big topic on its own, probably too big for this podcast. But you know, suffice to say, benchmarks are good to an extent, mm-hmm. but be careful about looking at just sort of blended yeah. averages across category. Yeah. Also look yeah. specifically at Android versus iOS, because the numbers will be different as well. But if I'm pushed to give you a general target, I would say, or general expectation, I'd say expect to retain between 30 to 40% of your new users within 1 month if you're doing pretty well. The best apps will mm-hmm. do more like 50 to 60%. A few will do 70%, but I've never really seen more than about 70% month zero retention.
Between the lines, you said something that you achieve 50% retention, over 50% retention mm-hmm. with SoundCloud after a few years or after some iteration. Talk to me about, because I experienced it firsthand too, like for early stage product, we do a lot of testing and validation and see what works and what not works. And I often find that founders or managing directors of a branch of a big corporate, they really want to get to the numbers that they want to look at. Mm-hmm. But it's often not the case. And sort of like got it between your lines too, 50% retention after some years. Talk to me about folks about the difficulty of getting a good product experience out there and how... I mean, leading question, because I'm in the field too, how it's not easy to really like get it good from the get-go, from the first iteration.
I mean, I would be amazed, you know, there's of course always some standout, like, you know, basically anomalous yeah. results where mm-hmm. where products just hit the market and they're immediately, you know, fantastic and massively adopted, right? Flappy yeah. Bird. Flappy Bird was, you know, coded by one guy in Vietnam. And got to number one overall in like almost every app store in the world at one point. You know, it got on some hype cycle, but it was genuinely engaging and fun. It was like basically the first hyper casual game, you know, before that term existed. You know, that's a great example of a game which bucks the trend, right? But, and I'm not just talking about games here, but like any app, right? There's going to be standout successes, but for every standout success that immediately just catches fire and goes viral, there's, you know, a million, probably 10 million apps, which they spend years iterating towards better product market fit and probably, you know, 900 and something thousand that never make it. It's really tough, right? There's a reason, a feature where we didn't choose to play in this space of really early stage and pre-launch apps. We very occasionally will consult big brands on launch strategy for launching new apps and maybe into new markets, but it's a really interesting problem. Is product market fit? It's not one which yeah. feature works on. But since you asked me to comment on it, I've given it some thought for sure. And you know, I think as the name suggests, product market fit. Here's my quick thoughts on it. Right. First of all, there's two parts to it. It's product and market. A lot of people think that they just need to iterate on the product. Maybe they just need to put another feature in and then it's going to suddenly be great, right? I see product teams routinely focusing so much on building features and maybe not talking to the market that much. Of course, there's also an argument for not always talking to the market. There's the or at least letting that drive all of your product decisions. There's you know, the famous quote from Henry Ford, if I'd asked the market what they wanted, I would have built a faster horse.
Yeah.
You know, so there's something to be said for like genuine heads down innovation, but nevertheless, right, there's iterating on the product involves like talking to users or at least seeing how users are using the product, you know, looking at early user cohort data, lots of iteration. Some of it might be new feature development, but there's probably also a lot of UX work just on you know, improving the just the way that the functionality is expressed and how that value prop is delivered to the user, right? But in parallel with that, and it usually starts even a little bit before the product's there in any real form, and that's the market part, right? So product market fit, it's about understanding and figuring out what your audience is, figuring out how to reach mm-hmm. that audience, figuring out how to target them, how to speak to them, what mm-hmm. kind of proposition you want to put forward out of probably, in some cases, you might have 10 value props, right, which you feel mm-hmm. like your app solves. You need to really zero in on the one which makes the most sense. Or maybe there's a different value prop for different audience segments. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can figure out how to sell the same app to multiple segments who have different needs. You know, that creates its own complexity, but this is all part mm-hmm. of figuring out your product market fit, understanding those buyer personas, and then tailoring the message towards them and tailoring the product experience towards them. So you're iterating at both ends of that. Hopefully, mm-hmm. over time, you know, you strike some gold and you may have some mm-hmm. kind of, you know, really nice kind of spikes in your numbers where you realize, okay, you're really getting somewhere with that, right? But many times also, you won't see that movement even when you expect to see it, you know, and mm-hmm. it's a long process. I always tell folks who come to a feature saying, hey, mm-hmm. we want to grow the app. It's the product's almost mm-hmm. ready. We just need to grow it now. And I'm like, well, look, you've probably got 2 or 3 years of, you know, strenuous product market fit iteration ahead of you, doing a lot of user testing and, you know, you need to do a lot of work before you're really ready for hyper growth, right? And we also see many examples of apps that, you know, probably thought they were ready for hyper growth, or whether they thought mm-hmm. they were ready or not, they just suddenly went viral for whatever reason. They got in the right press, or, you know, the right person tweeted it out on social, and just by some lucky coincidence, they got a lot of traffic very quickly. And often those apps kind of burn out pretty quickly as well, because maybe the users realize after some short time that, you know, they download it because of the hype cycle. They don't have a great experience actually within the app, or the app just can't keep up with the usage, and maybe it's downtime or other problems. And then those users are very hard to win back to give it a second mm-hmm. try a year later when the app is a bit better. So going viral early can also be disastrous for your business if you're not careful.
50 Cent said in the interview that you don't want your first song as an artist, as a new musician, to be a hit song.
Hey, that's actually wisdom. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, now it sort of resonated with me here when you were like breaking it down, because it stops you from learning.
Absolutely. Yes. You then become probably terrified of changing anything.
Yeah,
and then you just put out a. I mean, I'm not really a rapper by any means, but yeah, maybe you just try and produce songs in the same style, right? Like, and I think it's absolutely the case. It's a great parallel, great analogy that you made there.
Mm. Let's sort of like go back again to the onboarding, you know, and for the folks out there listening to this, the reason I'm really emphasizing on this is some have gone that far to say 80% of a product is onboarding, right? Exaggeration, of course, but it's very important, because if you don't get your onboarding right, you know, what's the point of like, you know, pouring million into this like app that you're developing? What's your strategies for folks that, you know, they're dealing with a mature product? They know their market, mm-hmm. they've achieved their product market fit, not only once, but maybe a few times. They have different customer type, buyers personas. How should they go about designing their onboarding experience? They have to talk to different buyers personas.
Okay, so there's multiple user personas or buyer personas who
yes.
the app is catering for, and it, you know, it's solving maybe multiple problems. So I like to reference some specific examples here. So SoundCloud would be a great one, because you've got mm. creators and consumers there. Like, it's a mm-hmm. classic two-sided marketplace.
Right.
You know, a lot of two-sided marketplaces, by the way, solve this by having two apps, right? So Uber has a driver's mm-hmm. app and a rider's app, right? That's mm-hmm. so they literally create different app experiences, because the functionality required to satisfy those two different personas, the driver and the rider, are so completely different that they don't want to clutch it all into one app experience. But there are many other examples where there is just one app, right? I'm going to go out on a limb here and say maybe Airbnb is one of them. I'm not sure. Maybe they have a host's app, but I think it's all just one app.
No, it's all one.
Okay, yeah. Great. So you can be a host and a guest on Airbnb, and it's all provided through one app. I should have known that before using it as an example, but glad to know I'm right. Yeah, other examples would be Pinterest, for example, which is actually got three personas. You've got creators who are like uploading brand new content, to create pins. You've got what I would call curators who are essentially repinning other people's content and creating new boards, collections of other people's stuff that other people have created. And created, by the way, could involve just bringing it in from other websites, like I'm including those in the creator group. And then you've got the consumer. So it's usually, by the way, the biggest group in any content platform. And that's the people who are just there to discover. And you know, maybe they're also engaging at some point in some light curation activity, but they probably start just by consuming. So again, it can get complex. Maybe you get users who actually have more than one persona, or you're trying to grow them into other personas over time, maybe. But in any case, you'll have some users who stick rigidly to one persona, and the consumers will usually be the biggest group if it's a content app. Mm-hmm. So let's just think about those examples there. Also SoundCloud, for example, you've got creators and consumers. So I'll use that example. So there's a couple of different ways you can approach it from an onboarding perspective. I've got a big preference for one of those, which will probably become clear. So the first thing is, and there's an argument for introducing everything within the app, and basically giving everybody a generic onboarding experience that shows them at least all of the possibilities, right? Now, that the advantage of doing that is that, you know, I might not even know when I downloaded the app that I can also create stuff with it, right? I might have just downloaded it to consume, but actually I can create as well. So, it's good to know that. And, you know, I might learn from seeing that in the onboarding. So maybe good to show everybody everything. The danger, of course, is that you create this longer onboarding. People get bored or they feel it's not relevant for them because this was not the value proposition that excited them, because they just want to consume. I'm downloaded SoundCloud. I want to listen to music. Why are you showing me about how to upload a track? I don't even make music, right? Like that's the risk. Okay, so, another possibility is that you can actually ask users, right? I'm a big proponent of asking users questions, right? Whether that's in focus groups and outside of the app experience in the real world, actually talking to real people, or asking a user within the app, you know, with a survey. You can deliver these with in-app messages through customer engagement platforms like Braze or CleverTap, but you can also hard code them. You know, there's various ways you can, you know, build interactions with the users. But like, you know, I would ask the user, hey, you know, what do you want to do here? What's your primary purpose? Do you want to discover great content? Do you want to upload your creations? You know, it's sticking with the creator consumer example. And then you can, of course, show them an onboarding which matches the thing that they want to do the most, you know, when they've just downloaded the app. You could always show them another step later. You know, if they're still around in the app a week later, you could say, hey, you want to see the creator stuff now? Like you seem to be, you know, doing well with your consumption. Maybe you want to, you know, or you can send them an email about it, you know, which is also what I would call kind of extended onboarding. And finally, you can do something which I call adaptive onboarding, which is maybe you show them a little bit of everything, or maybe you only show them what they're most interested in. So basically take one of the first two approaches. But then look at what they're actually doing within the app and trigger subsequent messaging or interactions with the users based on what they have or haven't done, right? If they have visited the upload screen and shown some intent about being a creator, start hitting them with creator onboarding. Like send them an email like, hey, you've got some stuff to upload. Here's how you do it, blah, blah, blah. Give them a pop-up right there on the creator screen. Hey, would you like some help with this? Do you want a tour? You know, that's what I call adaptive onboarding, right? Similarly, you may have features within the app, which the user has not discovered. If they've discovered them on their own and they've already used them, you probably don't want to get in their way with extra onboarding. They already figured this out, right? You might find that a user is, you know, turning out to be pretty like regular user. They've been in the app 3 or 4 times,
right?
But they've never seen the such and such screen, you know, it could be any, whatever feature it is, you know, they've never been to the map screen. So you know, that's also a great way to target these users with some extra information. Say, hey, would you be interested in checking out the map screen? This is kind of similar to, you know, if they've been a great consumer for ages, but they never visited the creator functions, you can kind of at least, you know, give them some information to make them make let them know that at least it's there, you know. And that can also be just like a fairly subtle UX touch, like putting a little marker on the tab that where the map screen is, just so that it draws their attention to it, so they're more likely to click on it. And then you can always pop up like, you know, a little info bubble or something that says, hey, this is the map screen, by the way, you know, when they land there. So there's many different ways you can expose those kind of interactions within the UX. But yeah, that would be my long answer on how I would, some different options for approaching multi-persona functionality and how to onboard people into it.
One thing that I highlighted in your words that, hey, just try to understand your user behavior. And if you see that they are gravitating towards certain new behavior, then put those actions, those functionality in front of them.
Right.
And that's just such a new take, because when we design onboarding, client has this tendency to, no, show them everything.
Yeah. Boy. And that's where you can get into really long flows, which are often, I'd say the worst case, it's just a carousel where people flip through and, you know, you've got 20 pages of carousel with no interaction. You know, nobody gets to carousel page 18. You know, if you're going to have a long onboarding, it needs to be engaging and interactive for sure. And yeah, the worst ones, which I see a lot, it's just a big long carousel. Like, yeah, I think people are going to read about the feature that's on page 18 of the carousel. Forget it. Yeah.
Yeah, forget it. It's been a long conversation. I really cannot thank you enough for giving us a crash course on app UX. I would like to end it with, because I think we covered a lot, especially a lot of topics about onboarding. I would like to end it with this question that for the folks out there, that how often should they revisit their onboarding?
Great question. And again, thanks for having me on. It's a great, good question to end on. Regularly. So, you know, there's a big danger that the product team or the dev team, however you've got it organized, you know, they work on the onboarding. Maybe they've even like revisited the onboarding, which is usually a big project, which gets talked about for sometimes a year before it actually happens. And then, you know, then there's some changes done. Maybe they're measured, maybe they're not, but there's a new onboarding that's launched and it's then becomes, you know, part of the app. And then that's it. Okay, we've done the onboarding. Let's move on to the next thing. They're generally not looking at the data. They're generally not seeing if it's improved things. And even if it has, they're not generally thinking, okay, can we improve this more, right? What you mentioned something about, there's like a quote of the onboarding is like 80% of the product. Honestly, it's where you lose 80% of your users. Going back to that quote about the, you know, I mentioned the stat about 80% of Android users not going to come back past, I think, day two,
right?
Like this, right? So from that perspective, onboarding is where you're going to reach the biggest chunk of your users. Most of the users, if they don't onboard well and don't activate, are not going to be around to see anything else that you do later, right? So it's where you can reach the biggest audience outside of, you know, the app stores and things themselves. The audience that's actually in your app is biggest in the new user cohorts. The cohorts slim down considerably after that. It's just a fact. So, you know, you're exposing all of these new users to the onboarding process. You want to retain as many of them as possible. Your new user retention rate is super important. So it should be something which, you know, if not continuously iterated on, at least should be revisited regularly, at least a couple of times a year. You know, with a proper initiative around improving it and, you know, trying out some new stuff, trying some big, bold ideas, testing them against the existing stuff. You know, it shouldn't be static, because the last part of product market fit, which I never really got to, is that product market fit is also not static, right?
Yeah.
What was great for your audience a year ago might not be great for your audience next year. By the way, they've got competitors out there releasing innovative new products. The expectations in the market suddenly change. Suddenly, your product that had amazing product market fit doesn't have it anymore. This happened to Nokia, by the way, going back to the start of the story. you know, that was a classic problem of product market fit changing. They were on top of the world. Then, the iPhone comes out. It wasn't just the iPhone, but, just other competing products which kind of jumped the shark. And suddenly, Nokia's product market fit went out the window. And they, like many companies, never really were able to get back to it. And it's the same with mobile apps. You need to work on your onboarding and just think about how your, more broadly, think about how your product is relevant to the audience and make sure that that's reflected in your product and in your onboarding at all times.
Product development is a never-ending game of developing the ideas, launching it, testing it, and I could not express it better than what Andy Carvel said. Andy, thanks a lot for taking your time. I know you're a busy man. It's Friday evening. Any last words?
I just want to say thank you so much for having me on, Bharat. This has been a real pleasure. Really enjoyed it. That is my last words. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ciao. Bye-bye.